All right. Welcome to the Michael Slate Show, and that's Decisions from Outer National. And once again, yeah, lots of decisions to consider, to think about, to move on, all kinds of stuff. At the back end of the show, we're going to be talking with Cynthia Flores, the legal and policy counsel for CHRLA, the Coalition for Humane Immigrant Rights, and Michelle Chai of Refuse Fascism in L.A. All right, and that's going to be not Refuse Fascism in L.A., but Refuse Fascism L.A., although you should refuse fascism in L.A., as well as all over the country. And I'm going to stop talking before I get all mixed up here now, all right? All right, yes, it's still early for me. And opening the show up, I'm really pleased to be welcoming back to the show Sansara Taylor, writer for RevCom.us, Revolution newspaper, and one of the initiators of Refuse Fascism. And we're going to be talking with Sansara about the upsurge against sexual harassment and abuse that is way overdue and way important. But before we get into that, there's something I wanted to start the show off with, and that's take a moment to remember Ursula Le Guin, who died this week at the age of 88. And back in 2009, maybe a little bit earlier, I interviewed her. And you can listen and download that interview on my website, themichaelslateshow.com. We talked about our latest book, Voices at the Time, which depicts a society taken over by theocrats who have made reading and critical thinking punishable by death. Our 35-minute conversation was wide-ranging, and at one point I commented on the theocrats and Christian fascists and how she showed that not only could such a takeover happen in the U.S., but it could happen easily. Now, of course, those Christian fascists are in the White House, the Supreme Court, and are moving quickly to suppress dissent everywhere. We should think about one of the things Ursula said in relation to that. She said, "Let's give Margaret Atwood a little credit. In The Handmaid's Tale, remember how she had a really quite easy takeover of the United States by a theocratic government. One thing they did was simply stop all the credit to women's credit cards, a couple neat little tricks like that." She was thinking along those lines, too. She realized way back how easy this could happen if the people aren't looking, or if they're clinging to their comfort and ignoring anything that makes them uncomfortable. So once again, check out the entire interview at themichaelslateshow.com. Let me know what you think about it, and think about the deadly consequences of people clinging to their comfort and ignoring anything that makes them uncomfortable. And especially in times like this, it's really important that people start thinking, okay? So now I want to welcome Sansara Taylor to the show. Sansara, welcome.
Hi, Michael. It's great to be with you.
You too. Good to be talking with you again. Let's jump into this, because I want you to know I have about 18 questions for you, okay?
Oh, boy. And I want to, I have to tell you up front, I want to sneak in a little bit of conversation about what's happening to immigrants, maybe at the tail end.
Yeah, sure, sure.
I know you're talking with others about it later, but it's such a moment of escalation of the attacks, so maybe we can sneak that in on the tail end. But go ahead with your 18 questions.
All right. Well, it's not really 18. I lied. All right. Anyway, the first. More than a million people in cities all over the country marched on January 20th, and this was marking both the Women's March a year ago and demonstrations against the installation of the fascist Trump regime last January. I want to talk about the significance of this in a broad sense right away, just to give sort of an umbrella for people to consider here, all right? So what do you think about the significance of this whole, of that whole action, that whole, what was going on that day?
Well, I think, it's starting a year ago with the original women's marches with millions and millions of women in this country and around the world, and then continuing in different forms, and then again last weekend out in the streets with a million marchers. I think it's really important that women and others have been standing up, have been raising their voices, have been reacting. I think there's been a visceral disgust and disbelief and outrage at the fact that you have ascended to the most powerful position in the world, a man who has bragged about sexual assault, Donald Trump. I mean, a lot of what people are raising their voices and expressing their anger about has been going on for a long time. It's not just a Trump problem, but there is a way that there's been a shock and an insult of having a man who is this craven and bringing back with a vengeance a lot of the misogyny, a lot of the women hating, a lot of the open degradation that women have fought very hard to put in the past and had felt that some progress had been made, and now it's being snatched away and with a vengeance. And so I think it's really important that people stepped out and raised their voices. And I think anytime people come into the streets in a public way and see each other and express their anger and express their desire for a world, for a different morality, a different culture, a different future, it really opens up the imagination and possibilities. It opens up and it gives people a sense of our collective strength and power. And I think this was really felt last week, and I was thrilled to be out at the women's marches. And I have to also say there was a real generosity of spirit and largeness of mind expressed as well. You know, you had signs supporting the Dreamers. You had signs calling out, I got to watch my language on the radio, but calling out the president as the asshole and not the people from Haiti and El Salvador and the continent, not the country, the continent of Africa. You had people expressing their solidarity with Muslims and with the planet and against a lot of what Trump and Pence represent. And this is really important, this sentiment, and people mobilized out in the streets in this way. Mm-hmm. I thought it was a big strength.
Yeah. That was one of the things that really impressed me as well when I was just watching it and seeing what happened here in L.A. And you know, you think about the numbers of people that came out. I mean, L.A., I don't know, maybe I was the only one that was surprised that it was 500,000 people, but I don't think so. And it was really exciting that there were 500,000 people there. And then to see how that rolled out across the country, you saw both the stark declaration of, we are not going to sit idle anymore. We're not going to sit here and we're not going to have our, you know, just talk to our neighbors and friends, but we're actually going to get out into the streets and do something around this. And I thought that this was really important in terms of, as you're saying, both all the attacks that were brought down have been brought down on women, but also focusing on that women are actually, they're human beings and they're not, you know, they're not everything that this society tries to reduce them to, whether it's sex toys or cleaning people or whatever, or baby raisers or handmaids. You know, this is not what's going to be allowed to stand. And I thought that was extremely important. And what I saw in terms of the enthusiasm and the ferocity with which women were speaking to that and the sense of humor that when people would actually, the kinds of things that they were putting out there that were pillorying, you know, the various Christian fascists and the anti-woman people out there.
Yeah, I think we also have to say, because in any upsurge, in any outpouring, even a very positive one, which we've seen over this last year with women, and I would think, you know, I would characterize the women's marches, but also the Me Too movement and the Time's Up and the many expressions against sexual assault and degradation, which have also really probably had an impact on why L.A. was the biggest women's march this year, was the Me Too outpouring that began in Hollywood. That's speculation mm-hmm. on my part. But these kinds of things build and they reverberate. In any upsurge, there's a need, different patterns and trends emerge, and there's a need to sort out what direction. And so I have to say, I thought the outpourings were tremendous and very important in many, many ways. The outrage, the anger, the calling out of Trump and Pence and their dark ages fascist program, and the celebration of a different culture and morality. At the same time, I thought one of the take-home messages that was projected from a lot of the stages and the speeches and even in the crowds with the signs, this idea that we're gonna go to the polls and we're gonna stop this, we're gonna grab him by the midterms, we're gonna take back the Senate and the Congress and the White House. I think this is this has to be critiqued, because what you actually, you know, you're not gonna stop what I think is a fascist regime. I don't just think it. I believe this is, you know, by every category, every definition, every criteria, Trump and Pence are a fascist regime who do not have respect for the normal official political processes, who are ripping up the norms, who are attacking the courts, who are remaking, you know, the gerrymandering and all of this, remaking the electoral playing field, that really people have to defeat this by doing what they did last weekend, coming into the streets, not funneling their energy into candidates and an electoral process, which is frankly never how change has happened, never ever how change, real change in the interest of humanity has ever been wrenched in this country. It's always been by people going into the streets and putting themselves on the line. And it would be a really big loss if this was funneled in that direction. And instead, for people to actually continue to manifest in public in opposition. And this is where, you know, I think last year about the Women's March with 4 million and how, and people saw each other. And it was like, it made such a difference to be out there in our outrage, in our defiance, together. And then a few days later, Trump passed his first Muslim ban. And everybody had this sense, we don't have to take this. There's a lot of us. Let's go to the airports. I don't think you would have had those really tremendous and very important airport protests that stopped the first version of the Muslim ban. I mean, the courts officially stopped it. But I think it's reasonable inference to say that the outpourings had a lot to do with why the courts stopped that first Muslim ban. But I don't think you would have had that had there not been the Women's March before it. You have this dynamic where people start to feel their strength. They feel their power. They are seen by the world. They're seen by the regime. They are seen by every ruling faction. They're seen by every disaffected person. And that can become a political force. And I just think this is something that we really should imagine. People should imagine if a million people who had come out last weekend, if they came out again this weekend, if they came out again next weekend, if they kept coming back with the demand that this regime must go, not that eventually later we might vote some other people who are likely to capitulate to you like the Democrats have been doing, but we are going to demand this change now. This regime must go. That is a force that could actually create a political crisis in this country where the regime would be forced out, where different political necessity would be presented to those who sit in the halls of power and have the ability to make that happen. But it's actually by manifesting in this way in the streets. And I think, you know, this is why I felt it was very, very positive last week. And it was very positive, the outpourings. But there's also a need for people to divide out a little bit. What was the strength of that and how that could be squandered or how that could be built upon?
Mm-hmm. I want to actually talk a little bit more about that, about what was the strength of that and how it could be squandered or built upon. Because one of the sharpest expressions against the oppression of women was it was hitting hard at sexual assault and the institutional cover-up of all that women face in a million expressions every day. And it's, I think a lot of people, and I think especially, this is actually kind of telling, it's especially for a lot of men who were kind of like, what? It's that? Really? Every woman goes through, really? Facing this kind of situation? And even people who consider themselves and are, to all intents and purposes, are really fervently and honestly saying, look, I'm against the oppression of women, I'm against this. But that whole idea of not understanding that this is something that has actually encapsulated and imprisoned a lot of women in their daily life from the time they're born till the time they die. And this was something that seemed to be really coming out, you know, expressed in certain ways in the mammoth turnout, but also what people were saying, what people were thinking.
Yeah, I think so. And I think there's a lot that people learn to live with when it's not challenged. And there's a way that women have not only been surrounded in their daily lives and their physical conditions in their workplaces, in their homes, in their churches, in their mosques, in their schools, but also in the psychic space, the cultural imagination, in the pornified culture, in the rampant and mainstreaming, degrading, dehumanizing pornography, in the music and in the television shows and movies that portray things that where women are accessories to men, where women are they're socialized and they're portrayed as sex objects or people who are put on this planet to please and serve men and find their value in whether they are highly valued sexual commodity, a highly sought after sexual commodity. This is what surrounds women, and it socializes men and boys from a very young age to see women as less than human, as to see sex as conquest, to take pride in pushing or maybe overcoming a woman's resistance to sex, to think that that's what makes him a man, or to even find, you know, to get turned on by degrading and dehumanizing a woman. That's what pornography is. That's what mainstream, that's what substitutes for sex ed in this country. You know, you have the Puritanism of abstinence only and Christian fundamentalism and a cult of virginity and then a pornified culture. And they reinforce each other. And so this has gone on, and frankly, it's gotten worse. And it's taken this really grotesque expression with Trump, the pussy grabber in chief, and Mike Pence, the Christian fascist theocrat, and their marriage, which actually comes together on both see women as less than human, both see women as property. I mean, there's other things they share as well, the white supremacy, the American chauvinism, there's other things, but this misogyny is very deep. And for that to be called out, for the women who've been forced to live with this, which is every woman who's been forced to live with this her whole life, to have it called out, to start to go, oh, this is not a personal problem. This is not just the way it is. This is wrong. And to raise their voices and to demand it stop. And for men, including men who never had to think about it before, who thought this was an isolated incident here and there, to see the pervasiveness of this, and men who have thought about it, but to really be, you know, and men should hear what's being brought to the fore and really take on board what it means to be female in this world of male domination and degradation. That when it starts to be called out, and this again is why it's so important that it come out against the institutions, the culture, that comes out in a mass way in the streets, because then you create a social force and dynamic where it breaks the isolation and the shame, and many, many more women can step forward, and many men can and should step forward and join this struggle. And then we have to sort out what kind of a society, big questions get opened up. What kind of a society, what kind of a system do we live in where it's not just, you know, widespread misogyny and sexual degradation, but it comes and it's concentrated at the top of the institutions and the state and the structures of the system that we live under, the system of capitalism, imperialism, and patriarchy is woven into all of that. And I think these are questions people need to look at. What would it take to get to a society and a world where this was not what was reinforced from the state and from the dominant culture and the dominant institutions? That, I believe, will take a revolution. That's very important for people to start grappling with. But this raising of people's sights and refusing to tolerate and opening up the question of what kind of world is possible is very important. And this has been a great contribution of this whole last period of upsurge that has got people thinking about this. And a lot more, it has to go much further. It has to be supported. And people have to dig into where does this come from and how do we put an end to it.
Mm-hmm. Let me remind listeners that you tuned into the Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Sansara Taylor, and we're talking about the Women's March and basically, what about it? What do people think about it, the hundreds of thousands in the streets across the country versus the Trump-Pence regime, and how we need a lot more of this? And Sansara, let me ask you this, because one of the things, too, that comes up with this is that it's very heavy, because when you look at this, when you look at what happens, and I don't know. Everybody's always, you've seen this many times, and anybody who's actually been out among people who have been fighting for something or fighting against something, and there's this sudden point of a breakthrough in terms of, I mean, look, when you're talking about 500,000 people in LA, when you're talking about hundreds of thousands in New York and Chicago and other places, and then you're talking about, you know, all these other cities that have all the, you know, have smaller numbers but significant, and even seeing things happening in other countries where women are expressing their solidarity, women and men, some men, but expressing their solidarity with women in general and with the movement that's developing here. When you look at all this, there's still this point about you're going after. There's sort of an institutional oppression, and I think it's really important that people understand that there's an importance to recognizing that, as you pointed to, that this is actually a product of the way society is organized, and it's not like it can't be fought against because people do have to take it up, but it's not mainly a question of just sort of like, well, if we can just show people the wrongness of their ways, that's true. That's important to do that. But there's actually a whole way that this plays into and is a critical part of the way the society is organized.
Yeah, I think one of the most important things for people to know, and I think some of the struggle recently has opened up space for people to reckon with this, but I think it's a question that needs to be dug into in its own right, that the oppression of women is not human nature. It's not boys will be boys, and, you know, women will just be the way that they are. It's socialized. It's not innate. It comes from the culture and the institutions we live under. And that, you know, it's a very deep thing. One of the very earliest divisions among all of human society a few thousand years ago was the division into antagonistic classes, where some people would live off the labor and the work of others. And as part of that, the domination and the oppression of women by men. And these changes, they weren't human nature, but they happened together, because once you develop a class-divided society, once you have private property, and not just in the sense of like my personal toothbrush, but in terms of who owns the land to farm off of, or who owns the major means of production, the ability to produce the requirements of life, it starts to matter whose children belong to which man, whose children will grow up to be part of the rulers, and whose children will grow up to be part of the slaves or the laborers or the peasants. It starts to matter who's inheriting what property. And that matters to the class divisions, to the social cohesion. And with the development of class divisions, you have patriarchy. And you codify the role of women as property of men, as breeders of children, who have to be virgins before they get married. That's why virginity is enshrined in every major religion. And where once married, they become breeders of children to their husbands, and they have to be virgins before they get married. So you know that the children are their husband's children, and the property goes to his children and his sons. And if you don't fit that, then you can be a whore, a sex object cast out to be used and discarded in that kind of a way. Now, that that virgin and whore dynamic is not human nature, but it's been with us a long time. It's been woven into every class society, slavery, peasant societies, feudal societies, and it's woven into capitalism and imperialism, too. And, you know, it's in different forms. Capitalism is a different kind of a class society, and it's one where, you know, everything is turned into a commodity to be exchanged, and where different blocks of very big capitalists with huge resources and means of production compete with each other, brutally exploit huge numbers of people across this planet to produce commodities and accumulate profit and beat each other out while most of humanity gets ground up working for them. And in this process, women's bodies, not only do you have the traditional forms of patriarchy, but you have the ways that this is woven into capitalism, and women's bodies and sex itself becomes a commodity. And women get reduced to sex objects to be traded, to be marketed, to be used to sell things in advertisement, to be sold through pornography, or literally sold through the sex industry and the strip clubs and the sexual slavery and all the rest. And this is, I'm taking a little time to walk through this, but I think it's important because it comes from somewhere. And if you understand that it comes from somewhere, it's not, it didn't fall from the sky, it wasn't ordained by God, it's not written into our DNA, it's historically evolved. If you understand it came from somewhere, you could start to grapple with how could you get rid of it. And I'll just add, because I think it's, you know, I want to give people some direction on this, is that Bob Avakian, the chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party, has done a lot of work analyzing the way that capitalism, imperialism, both because it's such a dynamic system, it's both undermined traditional forms of patriarchy, and it's commodified women and hyper accelerated new and even in some ways even more perverse forms of patriarchy, more vicious fundamentalist, you know, virginity and enforcement of women as breeders all over the world, including with Mike Pence here and everything he concentrates, and the anti-abortion laws and the anti-sex ed and the anti-birth control and all of this, and in the more and more commodified version of Donald Trump and sexual predation and all of this. And I think, you know, that the fight today to unleash the fury of women against all of this, against the regime in power, against the deep social relations, against the thousands of years of tradition, is very important. And at the same time, it's got to be increasingly connected with people digging into what kind of revolution is possible to get rid of this. And that's something that Avakian has done path-breaking work on in terms of really the need to make a complete and total revolution, a communist revolution, a new kind of communist revolution that has the fight for the complete liberation of women as a major driving force through the struggle now to make a revolution and in a new society after a revolution to completely break all the chains on women and every other section of the people. He said, you cannot break all the chains but one. You can't say you want to end exploitation and oppression against people in general, but keep women enslaved by men. And so this is something, you know, people should check out the pamphlet from him, Break All the Chains, at revcom.us, or go to read the Constitution for the New Socialist Republic that he's written, and dig into this at the same time that we continue to take this to the streets and challenge everything about the institutions and culture right now.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. I was thinking about that, actually, of going into that. And I wanted to, in relation to that, I think this point about that you've made a number of times, and it's been made in other places as well, but this point about epistemology and a correct epistemology and all this is extremely important, because people do have to, and it's true, I think a lot of people I've spoken with, but men and women who basically, they don't have an understanding of where this all comes from. And because of that, they even flop around a lot when they're thinking about, what standards should we be looking at? And what kind of methods should we use in fighting this? And where do we go? And that seemed to be something that, one, was like, it's from what I could tell, from what I could look at, and what I've heard from people who were out here in L.A. talking about it, that this is something that is a subject of debate and discussion within the movement as a whole. And I think more broadly in society, how do you actually, you know, you have to figure out how do you tell where the suppression comes from, and the importance of actually taking a, not just sort of like flailing around and just going out for anybody who says boo, but actually, you know, really digging into what's the cause, and then you can go to the solution from there.
Yeah, I think it's really important that in everything, in every realm, and this too is a hallmark of what Bob Avakian, as a revolutionary leader over many decades, has fought for, and it's a core part of the new synthesis and new communism that he has developed, is in everything, you have to go for the evidence. You have to base yourself on what is actually true. And truth is objective. You measure it up against what are the real material causes in the world, and what are the dynamics that tie those causes together that explaining what you're observing. And, you know, here, it's work. To dig into the roots of women's oppression, it's work. But if you want to solve a problem, you have to understand it. And I think this has really immediate implications, and it's one of the things being fought out in the Me Too movement right now, which, again, is overwhelmingly a very positive upsurge. But you have, and it's funny, I was just talking to a dear friend of mine about the case of Aziz Ansari, the comedian, actor, writer, who has been accused of pressuring a woman into degrading sex that she did not want, or the accusations that were made against Al Franken, or many of the other accusations in the Me Too movement. And she was saying, and a lot of people feel this, we've had so long that women have been disbelieved. That women have been disbelieved when they come forward and talk about assault and abuse and rape. That, and she was arguing, we have to make our criteria believing the woman. And a lot of people feel this way, and for reasons that I can understand and appreciate. But I think that we'll get ourselves into trouble that way, because while most women are telling the truth, that is not the same as saying that every woman in every circumstance is telling the truth. You still have to go by evidence, and you have to evaluate when there are accusations made. And we should fight against the culture that shames women and blames women and disbelieves women. We should not call a woman suspect for no reason. But we still, like in any other crime, when somebody is accused, you have to evaluate the evidence. And, you know, Avakian has made this very profound point. He says, look, until we get to a world where things are not adjudicated by narrative, meaning I choose to believe this one or I choose to believe that one, but based on objective criteria, objective evidence, until we get to a place where people widely go for the truth as what is objective and what you can prove, you will forever be trapped in a world where might makes right, where whoever has the most power can impose their narrative. Whatever they think is right, they can impose through their disproportionate power and platform. And you see that right now all over the place. I mean, you see it in history, things like, I think of the Scottsboro Boys or Emmett Till, you know, the long history of black men being lynched or brutalized or terrorized in many different ways for the mere accusation of sexual impropriety against white women. And, you know, that's because you live in a white supremacist society. So once you take away the criteria of truth being objective, you can have all kinds of misuse, even of something as important as believing and examining real accusations of sexual assault. You still have to go by evidence. And the world is messy. You know, we have to fight against the disbelief of women. We have to fight against the shaming of women. But we cannot substitute accusations for convictions. We cannot substitute rumors for a decision that somebody is guilty. And so there's a lot that needs to be sorted out in this fight. And it's, you know, I know it's probably unsatisfying to people listening, because this needs to be, you know, there's a lot of complexity to this, and there are big ideas. I don't mean it's unsatisfying, because there's not meaning to what I'm saying, but there's a lot of work to do to sort this out. But it's important that we have this conversation, because we have to actually unleash even more of this struggle against patriarchy, misogyny, sexual assault, and all of this. But we have to do it in a way where our means are consistent with the kind of world we want to create. And that's where we actually transform people, not exact revenge against people, where we transform the whole society and not end up letting the struggles of the oppressed against their oppression get used by those in power to derail.
Yeah, it's interesting, because that's exactly where I was going to go with this. And it's I want to remind listeners that we're talking with Sansara Taylor, and we are talking about the Women's March 2018, the hundreds of thousands in the streets across the country versus the Trump-Pence regime, and how we need a lot more of this, and what actually happened, and what's the importance of the movement, and where is it going, how is it getting there, and what each one of us has to deal with, has to take up and understand and think about. And Sansara, we have about 10 more minutes, if that, maybe. Or my producer is saying no, I think we have 5 minutes. So I want to try and get at this, though, because there is a point to this is something that's extremely necessary. It's good, it's positive, it's necessary. And then there's all this struggle that you're talking about, the retribution or transformation. Is that what's it going to be? Is it going to be, because I was thinking of Matt Damon, and you look at what happened with him, and how he kind of just shut up, and you know, whatever it was, whatever he was saying, it seemed to be true. It seemed to be, you know, the things that he was stating. But at the same time, this idea of understanding that this is, for one thing, it's one of these giant movements that, yes, there's going to be mistakes, but we have to really struggle to kind of figure out what's really needed, what's really true, and what's really needed, and how do we get there? What are we looking for? Are we looking for retribution against those who've wronged women, or are we looking generally broadly, or are we looking for transformation of the entire society? And that's something I think that whole thing, and this has to be carried out on a very principled basis.
Well, just because you mentioned Matt Damon, and I don't know if people know what you're referencing, and there's a lot of different views on what he said, but he recently made the point that all forms of sexual harassment and assault need to end, and he was expressing his support for the Me Too movement. He said, at the same time, I think we need to develop the maturity to tell the difference between patting somebody on the butt and sexual assault or pedophilia. And he said, all of them need to end, but we have to handle them differently. And he disagreed with the way Al Franken was gone after, and he had different opinions. And immediately, Matt Damon was told to shut up. He was told that he was doing harm. He was told that no one should make any distinctions between levels of assault or harassment. And he was told, as a man, you have no right to speak. And this, I thought, was wrong. I think men have not only a right, a responsibility to speak on this. This is part of the truth is objective. Men do have to listen to the experiences of women. They have to appreciate what it means to be female in this world. But men have a responsibility just as much as women to this fight and to this struggle and to put forward their best understanding. And there is a difference between sexual harassment and groping and sexual assault and rape. And, well, groping can be an assault, too. I want to make the right distinctions here. But there is a difference, and it matters. And it doesn't matter because it's not all of a fabric or because it doesn't all have to change, but because people who really, somebody like a Harvey Weinstein, if you do the kinds of things that he did, you should be held to a different punishment than if you do what Al Franken was accused of. And especially if it's been proven or if it's just a rumor or accusation like what Al Franken faced, we do have to sort that out. I don't want to live in a world where every form of degrading behavior that men exercise towards women is criminalized. I want to live in a world where it's uprooted, where men are not socialized to behave that way anymore. And that requires holding rapists accountable. It requires punishing people when it can be found that they did wrong and crossed criminal lines and really violated a woman in those kinds of ways. But it also requires that we open up a conversation and don't tell men to shut up as soon as they join it, if they're doing their best to join that conversation. And everybody's comments should be evaluated based on, are they true or not true? Do they measure up to reality or not? Nobody should be told to shut up because of who they are. And I have to say, it really matters because the most profound work done on how we can make a total revolution, how we could dig up the entire roots of the oppression of women, plus the white supremacy, plus the way imperialism has plundered the globe, plus the way thousands of years of class society have enforced ignorance on the mass of humanity. The person who's done that work should be listened to, regardless of his identity. His name is Bob Avakian. He's developed a new communism. He should be evaluated on its merits, you know, and just like everybody else should be. We should fight against the very, very widespread culture that dismisses women because they are women. That should not fly. We should get rid of the culture that dismisses and looks down upon the contributions of people because they come from a different country and have an accent, which goes on all the time. We should get rid of those horrific prejudices and biases that stand in the way of evaluating everybody's thinking and ideas based on objective criteria. But we have to evaluate based on this. Whatever ideas are being brought forward, do they help us get at the truth, and do they help us wage the fight for liberation or not? Mm-hmm. And this is something all of us have to do. Now, I know we're going to be out of time, but I do want to say something about what's happening with immigrants. Is that
okay?
All right?
Quickly.
Yes. I just want to say refusefascism.org is about to put out a major statement on this. in the last 2 weeks, I mean, xenophobic nationalism, white supremacy has been such a core part, a linchpin and battering ram of the whole Trump-Pence regime, its whole fascist agenda. But in the last 2 weeks, there has been a major qualitative escalation of the anti-immigrant programs from the attack on the Dreamers and the threat to end the Dreamer program, 800,000 youth, to the ending of TPS, which is 250,000 immigrants, many of whom will be forced to be deported back to dangerous places where many will die, to the promise that came out from ICE recently that they are going to raid the sanctuary city of San Francisco and arrest at least 1,500 undocumented people as a form of terrorizing immigrants and breaking the sanctuary movement, to systematic targeting of immigrant rights leaders, which has happened in New York City and in other cities where prominent, high-profile leaders like Ravi Ragbir and others have been detained, snatched from their homes as a part of breaking the entire movement. And the racialization, the white ethnic cleansing of this, as concentrated in that asshole nations remark that Trump made. All of this is a major escalation, and it's happening now, and it has to be resisted. It has to be resisted by everybody, wherever you were born, but especially people born in this country, and white people need to stand up against this, and they should go to refusefascism.org. We need to do this to stop a enormous crime against humanity, and we have to do this because the lesson of Nazi Germany and every other fascist experience is you have to stand against those who are first under attack, or you will be in a worse place, not a better place, to stand up against all the other horrors which are coming behind this. So this is I know you're going to have this section, other people come and talk about this. I'm very glad I'll be listening. Mm-hmm. I just want to say this. Please come to refusefascism.org. We want to talk with you. Movements and groups need to be talking with each other. We want the first week of February to be major outpourings of resistance all over the country where we're standing together and mobilizing everybody.
Okay. All right, Sansara, thank you very much. All right. And we'll talk to you again soon. All right.
And thanks,
sure. All right. That was Sansara Taylor, co-initiator of refusefascism.org and writer for revcom.us, Revolution Newspaper. We're going to take a quick musical break and be right back. Welcome back. That was City of Immigrants from Steve Earle. And right now, I just want to real quick move into a clip we have from Bob Avakian as we get ready to move into our next segment. So listen to this and we'll be right back.
Why is it that the Democrats can only try to resolve this on the terms of the system? And for that reason, cannot offer any alternative that is in our interest, in the interests of humanity? Why are they determined to keep things within the established norms and acceptable limits? We can turn to the words of Barack Obama shortly after Trump won the Electoral College vote. We, Democrats and Republicans, are on the same team, Obama insisted. And he made a point of saying that we should wish Trump well and help him succeed because his success is success for all of us. Well, we can say that here Obama was telling an important truth. Ultimately and fundamentally, they are all on the same team, which explains why the Democratic Party will only oppose what the Trump-Pence regime is doing within narrow limits and always in the interests of the team of which they are all a part. And really, we should all help Trump succeed with his fascist agenda because a successful fascism will be good for all of us? only with the perverted logic of the system all these politicians serve, and with the poisonous outlook of American chauvinism, could anyone put forward such a position? Like the Republicans, the Democrats believe in the superiority of the capitalist system of exploitation and the exceptional greatness of America and its empire. They champion a brave new world of 21st century globalization, which rests on a vast network of sweatshops where people, including children, slave long hours for near starvation wages. They firmly believe in the right of America to dominate the world and to overturn governments, bomb countries, and slaughter people to do so. But they say it should be done with the cooperation of allies and in the name of making the world more free, orderly, and peaceful. They will talk about diversity and inclusiveness while actually acting to maintain the fundamental relations of inequality and oppression that are hallmarks of this country, because those relations are built into this system and it could not exist or function without them. In short, even with their real differences with the Republicans, they represent and serve the same system, the systems whose normal workings have now brought fascists to power.
All right, welcome back. That was Bob Avakian, the chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party. And sisters and brothers, it's important to listen to things like what Avakian is saying there, and it's important to think about what actually is happening in the world and why is it that the Democrats, that every time the system talks, are people in the society who are constantly trying to tell us that the Democrats will come and help us, and the Democrats will actually do this. And it's time for people to wake up, to peel the fog away, to brush the fog away, peel the blinders off of your eyes, and just look around and think about what have the Democrats done, okay? Let's talk about that. We can talk about that pretty soon. Right now, I want to rush into this because we are running low on time. And I'm, you know, in the last week, in the last couple of weeks, there's been increasing, you know, threats from the system, increasing threats from ICE, increasing things that are happening, the raids on 7-Elevens all over the country, and a couple in particular here, the threat of people, you know, coming and just hunting people down. This is a huge assault on immigrants, legal and you know, legal and extra legal. And it's and basically it's time for people to figure out what the hell we're going to do about this. What's going to happen? Are people going to step back and say, "Oh, that's you know, I don't like it, but what can I do?" Or are they going to do something? And joining us to talk about this is Cynthia Flores, the Legal and Policy Counsel for CHRLA, the Coalition for Humane Immigrant Rights, and Michelle Chai of Refuse Fascism LA. Cynthia, welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you for having me. Really appreciate being on.
Sure.
And being able to talk about this very pressing and important issue.
Yeah, and Michelle, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Okay, and good to have you back. So, Cynthia, let's start with you. You were talking about the importance of talking about this. Well, let's talk about it. What exactly do you see as going on today and the danger?
There's an increase of aggressive and at times unlawful enforcement from ICE in particular, but the Department of Homeland Security in general. There is a very sinister approach to criminalizing and scapegoating immigrant communities. And we saw that with the 7-Eleven enforcement operations that took place over the last 2 weeks. And so we were active here in Los Angeles and responding to one of the incidents that took place, and we were able to confirm that while there was a kind of a guise, a excuse of entering the 7-Eleven, saying that it was an employment authorization operation, we did confirm that there was at least one collateral pickup, that meaning there was at least one person that was detained by ICE that was not the direct target of this enforcement operation. And what we're seeing is there is a complete disregard for community, for families, and there's an abuse of power that's happening on behalf of ICE right now.
Mm-hmm. Michelle, now I should tell people Michelle Chai is also, she's a representative of Refuse Fascism and refusefascism.org. And I wanted to ask you about this because you've also been out in the streets a lot in terms of and seeing what's happening there. And there is, you know, why don't you talk about this? This point about, look, ICE has already significantly expanded, as you know, as Cynthia's been just saying, it's significantly expanded immigration enforcement, including arresting people in their homes even. And when they check in with federal agents or go to court or something. So let's talk about that for a minute.
Yeah, well, I mean, actually, I was thinking about what you're just saying, that I heard somebody in a panel when I went to Phoenix for the Immigration Integration Conference, and somebody was talking about how her husband had been going to do regular check-ins with ICE, and then after this regime basically took office, then he went into for his routine check-in, and he was just arrested, and he was deported right away. So as we can see, and as how people have been talking about, this is actually an attack on immigrant people, and it's part of implementing a fascist agenda and going after people. And right now, it's actually immediate and urgent need for people to stand up and to oppose this and to not accept and to create the kind of, you know, of culture in society where people who do have papers and people who are not directly affected by this are coming to, you know, like what Chirla did to the 7-Elevens and actually stand with people and, yes, warn people that ICE is there, but actually to, let's take that further to a movement to drive out the Trump-Pence regime and stop the attacks on immigrants.
There really, when I think about this, there really is this point about, I was reading earlier this morning that these raids, and not just the raids that happened at the 7-Elevens, but these raids in general, there's already been a 40% increase in deportation arrests, giving, and that gives people a sense of the terror that people are living under, as you were saying, Cynthia. And it's sort of like, what actually happens to people when you're living like this? And I'd like to ask you this about, when you think about what needs to be done, what has to be done, what would you say? Because I think this point about resistance is extremely important. And I know that Chirla has been involved with a rapid response team that's been arguing that they, you know, and trying to actually mobilize people to come out and show up where raids are happening or are suspected of being about to happen. Let's talk about that, the response that needs to happen in the face of a really horrendous and fascistic assault on people to terrorize people.
Yes, absolutely. And so Chirla, the Coalition for Humane Immigrant Rights, coordinates the Los Angeles Raids Rapid Response Network. It's a response network of over 40 organizations based in Los Angeles whose primary purpose is to respond to enforcement operations, immigration enforcement operations in Los Angeles County. We're comprised of community-based organizations, legal services providers, unions, faith-based organizations, and we are a network. The way that we function is we have four separate arms of the network. We have an organizing committee, which takes care of our organizing component and verifies whenever we do receive a call that there is a raid taking place. We also have our legal committee, which takes on our cases pro bono. So whenever we do hear of someone that has been verified, that has been picked up, we provide pro bono legal representation. We also have our communications committee, which is tasked with informing folks that, one, we exist, providing them our information, but also releasing statements when we do verify these kinds of enforcement operations in Los Angeles and beyond. And then we have our political committee that works with local electeds and representatives from federal agencies to ensure that we can move a conversation forward about how we can distinguish enforcement operation protocol in Los Angeles and make sure that it's more humane and less adversarial.
You know, I keep thinking about this because it's just such a horror that you can imagine that people are going through. You know, when you're talking about the, you know, that actually what they're doing, and I think it's important what Chirla is doing. I also think it's important that there's an action needed by thousands of people to actually step up. And in a way, you know, I was really excited when I read about that 7-Eleven confrontation. And I thought actually, in a sense, there's really a need for people to be also, in addition to what you're talking about, there's a need for people to be out in the streets and organizing people to stand up against this. You think about these things about how the different things that were done to stand up against the Nazis in World War II, when Jews were being rounded up and killed and slaughtered and whatever. And people did all kinds of things to and unfortunately not enough. But one that when it did happen, they actually did heroically stand up and it made a difference. Now, Michelle, I'd like to ask you that about in terms of Refuse Fascism. Now, what are you folks doing in terms of a resistance to this?
Yeah, well, learning from everything that Chirla is doing in the Race Rapid Response Network, we did just forge a rapid response network within Refuse Fascism to contribute to a larger Southern California rapid response network and focusing on like the attacks on people from the Trump-Pence regime. So, and right now the immediate attack that every day, it started off in the months, weeks, and now it's like every day that there are these attacks against immigrant people. And so we are learning from what, you know, different organizations and how different people are handling the situation. And so we're doing social investigation, going out to some of these neighborhoods and talking to people and learning about how they're understanding what is happening and how they are preparing or what they're doing, right? And then we're also organizing people because as important as it is to educate people, we actually need to get into the streets and, again, create the kind of culture where we are bringing forward different people, not just immigrant people, but different sections in society. Like students in the universities need to bring down, you know, some of the, like their organizations and come and be a part of these responses. Like, for example, what Chirla did and being out there and calling this out. But also, like, for example, I was thinking about the video that surfaced around ICE going into the Greyhound and asking people for their papers. In some of the meetings where we were discussing this rapid response network, we were talking about what are some of the concrete ways that people can act. And that is one of the concrete ways. If people are sitting in a Greyhound and ICE comes in and they start asking for their papers, then you get up and you sit in the middle of that aisle and you prevent them from asking people for their papers. And you call on people to say, look, I'm not going to show you anything. And people in here should stand with me and not show them anything and stand with immigrant people and not let them take away this grandmother who doesn't have her papers, not let her be taken away, right? So these kinds of things is actually really needed. And right now we are in the beginning of forging this rapid response network. And we are, tonight we're going to be going out to MacArthur Park and talking to people and like some of the street vendors and learning how it is that they're thinking about this and, you know, and actually taking this all the way further to building a movement to drive out the Trump-Pence regime.
Mm-hmm. Now we have, unfortunately, folks, we have about 3 minutes. So I want you to each to think of something that you would want to say to wrap this up. Now, let's go with you first, Cynthia.
You know, thank you for having us. There are plenty of opportunities to get involved with the Los Angeles Race Rapid Response Network. Feel free to contact Chirla. You can reach us at 213-353-1333. But I also want to challenge folks, everyday folks that are listening to this program, that there are these structures in place where you can get plugged in, but it really does depend on us organizing one by one, block by block, street by street. We need to organize our community, and we're going to be the best defense for our people.
All right. And Michelle?
Yeah, I mean, I really think that's important. And, you know, and Refuse Fascism does, you know, is really uniting with everybody right now. And is, you know, because this actually is needed. And, you know, and again, not just to save a few people that are right in front of us, but actually to stop the attacks on women, on immigrant people, on Muslim people, to put a stop to that and to take this all the way further to drive out the Trump-Pence regime. And, you know, and again, this is a rapid response network that wants to contribute to a larger rapid response network. So we would like to contribute to this rapid response network that Chirla is talking about. And, you know, and we are calling on people to join up with us and to get involved with this and forging this unity with all these different organizations. So people should get in touch with Refuse Fascism LA. Our number is 323-946-1742.
Say it again slower.
323-946-1742.
All right. I want to thank each of you for coming on the show today, and we'll have you back both back. It's important that we keep talking about this, and it's important, I think, that we grow things as big as possible so we can have the biggest impact in up against a system that is determined to just get, you know, to just barrel over everything. And this is a, you know, when you talk about fascism, you're looking at it. You're looking at the face of it right now. You're looking at the modern day face of it, and the price that we pay, that we could pay, that we will pay if we don't recognize that and act on it is severe. And think about this. The list keeps getting longer. Raids, TPS ended, DACA ended. And I just saw today that the big scam that they're talking about, what that Trump is trying to do. And now after all this stuff about what he's going to extend DACA, he's going to do this, he's going to do that. All kinds of questions have been thrown up around it. Legal immigration targeted, activists targeted and deported. You think about what's happening on this. This is not acceptable. And this is only the first round. And it's going to get deeper. It's going to get harder. And it's going to demand more from us. And I want people to know, if you want to spell, if you want to talk to Cynthia, you want to look up a way to get in touch with Cynthia, you spell her name C-I-N-T-H-I-A, and that's her first name. And that's actually, it's important on that. And Michelle, people found out, heard about how to get hold of you. Do you have something you want to say?
Yes, actually, I forgot. We're actually putting together a response to these attacks on the humanitarian organizations in Arizona who are actually, they're going after them, right? And we're going to do a street action. We're going to line up water jugs and have the messages. And actually, we're trying to do something where we have a banner with the names of the people that have died in the on the border.
And Cynthia, I want to thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you.
And we'll have you back. It's very important to stay up on this. And
absolutely.
Let's get these streets filled with a lot of people that just ain't going to take it no more. All right? Okay.
Thank you.
All right, Michelle, thank you very much. All right, before I go out, I want to share some details about some things mentioned by the guests today. The important statement on immigrants that Sansara Taylor announced is called, "First they came for the Muslims, then they came for the immigrants, not this time. Stand up now with the immigrants. This nightmare must end. The Trump-Pence regime must go." And you can find that at refusefascism.org. And the activists that were mentioned by Michelle Chai are from an organization in Arizona called No More Deaths. Over 7,000 migrants have died crossing the desert in the past 20 years. No More Deaths leaves food and water that can save the lives of desperate people crossing the border. They recently documented how the Border Patrol has dumped thousands of gallons of this life-saving water onto the ground. And they also recently arrested 8 activists on federal charges of harboring an undocumented immigrant for giving out food and water. As always, you can find all these details on my Facebook page. And I want to remind people again, go to my website, themichaelslateshow.com, and check out the interview I did with Ursula Le Guin, an extraordinary human being who really just played such an important role in the world. And she died. She died recently, and she never stopped. But I want to actually encourage people to go to my website and check out that interview, all right? And I want to thank my assistant producer, Henry Carson, my board op, Teddy Robinson, and Jeff Pryor. There he is. I want to thank Jeff Pryor as well, my assistant producer as well. And each and every one of you for tuning in. If you want to write to me, you can at mslate@themichaelslateshow.com. Talk to you again next week.
Y como dice Rubén, un carro pasa muy despacito por la avenida. No tiene marca, pero todos saben que es policía. Cuidado con las armas de Brixton.